Hello, everyone, and welcome to Let's Take a Stab at It. I'm your host, John Hoyer, and with me is...
Jason Bartsch, and with us is...
Hello, heady. Here's the King of Halloween, Trevor Charity. What's up, peasants?
You really going to do that?
Amazing.
John, I don't have a lot in my life. I got to milk this.
So, for a little context, for our Halloween special, we did a game show, which was centered around Halloween, and Trevor won. And he's kind of now the self-proclaimed king of Halloween. That was never part of the prize.
I'm sorry. I remember hearing on that episode that, Trevor, you are clearly the king of Halloween.
Yeah, it was from you.
Yeah,
it came out of your mouth.
Yeah, I got a crown. I got a scepter. I'm actually sitting on a throne made of jack-o'-lanterns and that 15-foot skeleton from Home Depot. I'm sitting on it right now, guys.
Can't be too comfortable at all.
No, it's very comfortable. It is very comfortable.
You're not even on a webcam and you're talking about this.
So, John, have you recovered from that crushing defeat
yet?
Do
we have to talk about this?
Yep.
Trevor brought it up. I'm just...
Absolutely. Let's do it. I want to play-by-play.
You won by one question, Trevor.
John, what color is Freddy Krueger's sweater? I think you said black and red. No, it's green and red. Oh, silly Billy.
That wasn't the one you won by.
I know, but still, it's
it was a jack-o'-lantern stupid story that Jason, you colluded. You two colluded. I'm not here for this.
So who, I don't recall who actually won the section about today's film, Halloween. I don't remember.
Probably
I
think that me.
It might have been you.
He did. Yeah, the nerd.
I'm a nerd. You just did a whole hear ye bit, and I'm the nerd.
I'm monarchy. I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, I'm regretting all of this. Anyway, so we figured since we're doing a review of Halloween, we should have the King of Halloween on the show.
He also begged.
He begged.
I don't remember that. I really don't remember that.
And it's going to be a great episode. We all love the movie Halloween. It's one of our mm-hmm. favorites, and we're going to have some fun. But first, let's get into what we've been watching. Jason, what have you been watching?
So I have been working my way through Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Nerd.
It's something my parents always watched when I was growing up, and I was always intrigued by it. And I guess because of that, I've always been a big Patrick Stewart fan. He just kills that role. And I don't know. Rewatching it as an adult, it's really cool. I never realized how kind of philosophical the show got. And I think it probably has some of the strongest acting of all of the series.
Are you saying William Shatner's not a good actor?
You always have opinions about William Shatner. They came up in the Halloween mask question too. Did he do something to you? Did you not get a refund on Priceline at one point? Like, what happened?
He got emotionally scarred by Phil on the roof.
Well, you know what? When I used to work at a hotel, people that would book through Priceline, it caused a lot of issues, all right? And I'm still not over it, all right?
And Shatner caused that.
That's his fault.
That's
him
fair.
Him in that rug that he has up there. It's not fooling anyone, buddy.
John, what have you been watching?
All right, so I watched a movie called My Bloody Valentine, the original, from 1981, maybe. Mm-hmm. I would just say 1981 and just roll with it. But because of a certain previous guest, Chris Devlin, now I don't know what to think. I don't trust myself anymore. But anyway, I watched My Bloody Valentine. So for those that don't know, it's about a miner who goes around just hitting people with his pickaxe and killing them when it's close to a Valentine's Day dance that's going to occur. And what I liked about it was that the setting of it is in this like mining town. All the people that are in it are like mostly like blue collar workers and whatnot. So it just has a different flavor than just being a typical like slasher movie that has like everyone's in college and all that. So I like the, you know, kind of unique atmosphere. It's a little silly, as one might expect, but definitely worth everyone's time. I watched it on the new Scream Factory Blu-ray and it looked beautiful.
Mm.
So Trevor, what have you been watching?
I watched this new movie that came out on Shudder. It's called Violation. It's a very artsy horror movie. It's not like a lot of the movies that are on Shudder currently. It's about a woman and her husband are kind of like almost on the, like they're going to get divorced anytime soon, but they're trying to, you know, get the spark back. So they go and visit the woman's sister and her brother-in-law, which the woman actually has a kind of a history with. What unfolds is something like very, I don't want to get too into detail because there'll be a spoiler, but something terrible happens that leads to a plot of revenge. It just, it goes places. It really goes places. And the interesting thing is it hops to the future and then back to the day of the event. My only complaint is there's some points that are a slow burn, but all in all, I thought it was a very good movie.
Nice. All right. Before we talk about Halloween, I'd like to kind of start by getting people's opinions on what they think of the director, John Carpenter, maybe some favorite movies of his or whatever. Trevor, tell me what you think.
Well, I really, really love a lot of John Carpenter movies. He's probably one of my favorite directors.
Me too.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the films I really, really love to rewatch over and over again is The Thing. It has a great psychological vibe to it of just isolation and paranoia. You got They Live, where, you know, you got the legendary Rowdy Piper. Well, I'm a big wrestling fan, so that helps a lot.
R.I.P.
Yep, exactly. R.I.P. Escape from New York, which, you know, it's very, very good. You got Snake Plissken, you know, and then
Kurt Russell. He's Kurt the best. Russell.
Yep. Kurt Russell is the best. And actually, the actor who played Dr. Loomis is also in it. He plays the president.
Oh, yeah.
Does John Carpenter, what's his connection with Kurt Russell? Is he just like a big fan? He's in a lot of his movies, right?
Yeah, they're buddies.
Yeah, yeah. John Carpenter likes to use the same people he uses throughout the movies. I mean, he used Keith David in The Thing and They Live. He cursed Kurt Russell for a lot of his movies.
I respect that. Yeah. Like, as a director, if you get a rapport with a certain actor, I think it can elevate the film. You know, the actor kind of understands what you're going for and speaks your language, I think that's pretty invaluable. So
one thing I'd mention is on a lot of the recent Scream Factory Blu-rays for John Carpenter's movies, especially if Kurt Russell's in it, he will be in like the commentary track with John Carpenter.
Oh, they're just hanging. They're just pals.
They're just hanging out. They're chilling. Like, they're talking about the movie, but it's not like they're not analyzing it or anything. They're just kind of chilling out, talking about some stuff they remember. And my favorite thing is John Carpenter, whenever he doesn't seem like he wants to elaborate on a thing, he just goes, "That's correct." And they just keep talking.
Moving on.
I'm going to start using that for the pod. That's correct.
But yeah, no. So I love John Carpenter movies. I mean, for me, Assault on Precinct 13 is just one of his best films. It's his second film. It's a film just before he did Halloween. And it was kind of the reason why he was able to get this project off the ground. And Assault on Precinct 13, for anyone who doesn't know, it's a siege movie in a police station. And it's like almost like an unofficial remake of Rio Bravo. So it is a lot of fun. I think anyone who hasn't seen The Thing should be ashamed of themselves.
I didn't know we were shaming people on this podcast, John.
Sorry. Well, sorry, Jason.
Yeah, I guess monkey's out of the bottle. I'm going over this list. I embarrassingly have not seen any John Carpenter movies besides Halloween. And this probably won't make the edit. And, you know, John might fire me after this, but he knew what he was getting into. He knew what he was getting into going into this.
Here's the thing. We talked off mic and we decided, you know, when we can hang out again, I'm bringing all my John Carpenter Blu-rays. We're going to watch the movies. We're going to listen to the commentaries. We're going to teach him, you know, folks, we're going to get him.
That's correct.
Jason, do you want to do the synopsis?
Oh, do I? You just crush me down into like this small, and then you're like, all right, now do the one thing you actually do on this podcast.
Dance, monkey, dance.
All right. The synopsis for Halloween. 15 years after being institutionalized for murdering his older sister, Michael Myers returns home to wreak havoc on Halloween evening. So I know you guys are both big fans. We're all big fans of this one. Mm-hmm. I think some of this has, you know, kind of a nostalgic effect for us. I think that a lot of us kind of grew up with these characters and might have been kind of our first introduction to horror in some instances. Mm-hmm. So I guess just like beyond kind of the personal affiliation with it, what draws you guys to this movie? Like, what are your thoughts on it?
So, okay. I was watching, when I watched the Halloween 2018 version, the sequel that's also called Halloween.
Brilliant title. Why do they do that? That drives me crazy. There's like a million other things you could call it, or like.
Yeah. So when I watched that, I enjoyed that movie overall, and we'll talk about this in another episode, but I was trying to kind of see why certain things just didn't work for me at all in that film. And I was like, okay, I need to go back to the original, rewatch that, and just watch it, like, try to have no preconceived notions and just try to take it in as like a first time view or something, you know? Mm-hmm. So I watched it, and the thing I came away from it was that I love the filmmaking of it is just so amazing. And it has a lot of perspective shots of Michael walking places, following people, where you don't see his face or his mask. You just see kind of like portions of his arm or his body or whatever, just kind of slowly following people. And then you also get shots of like people, you know, Lori, we'll talk about this later, but Lori's like sitting in class and she turns and she sees Michael watching her. And it's just so creepy because I think this kind of element gets you into feeling like, while this is a horror movie, and it's definitely playing to certain kind of established tropes by this point, it gets you in this mindset of reality and what, you know, you would think of like someone's like hanging out with their friends and they just see this creepy guy walking by or watching them and things like that. And it just like messes with you. I don't know.
And it's even more unsettling too that it's, you know, kind of just takes place in like some suburban every town USA. Mm-hmm. And it's just such like a calm town that you wouldn't really have any sense that there's anything to dread. But then the dread comes along with Michael Myers. Like, he single-handedly adds the dread to the movie, which is, it's pretty fascinating.
The fact for me about Halloween is the questioning of Michael Myers, because you get the illusion that Michael Myers is just a person. You know, he has flesh and blood. You see his skin, like, on his hands. But throughout the movie, you think that he's something more, like something elemental, a force of nature. The fact that it takes so much abuse against him, like getting stabbed, getting shot, and then just simply getting up and walking away is just, it's literally pure evil. Like, they actually, one of the nicknames for Michael Myers, other than the shape, is evil on two legs. And you get the sense that he is more than just a person, that he is evil incarnate. Because if you look at the other serial killers, like, you know, Leatherface, a Jason, a Freddy, they all have motives. Michael, you don't see a motive. He just kills.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting too is this is the first, probably one of the first films in general, but definitely the first in our series so far, where the threat of the killer just like not staying dead is a threat at all.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's funny that, like, John, you were talking about how like so much of this movie has just become, they've become tropes over time, because it's set a standard for,
oh yeah,
so many things that, like, you know, somebody watching it now for the first time, it could come off as like cliche, but that's because it wrote the book on all of these things. Mm-hmm. Like, we're watching this film and, you know, like when Laurie stabs him for the first time, she's just like accepting that he's dead. And it's like, from what we know now with films, like, no, make sure, really make sure. And at least keep the knife with you. And as
we were talking about, like with the other slasher films, there's never been points where usually the people that get like attacked by a killer just get killed.
Right.
And Lori gets the best of him a few times. So you think, well, of course, well, she stabbed him in the neck. He's a person. He should be dead now. But nope, that's not the case. The shape, he lives on. And I think also the mask, we have to talk, the mask that he wears is It's so scary because you can't see his eyes. It's just kind of like emotionless, like blank slate, which is how Loomis talks about Michael when he was seeing him without a mask on.
The mask is just so iconic. And the score, obviously, like probably one of the greatest scores for any horror film, for sure, if not any film. Yeah. And, you know, the mask, there's stories behind the mask, which we got to in our game show a little bit. So it was actually a Captain Kirk mask.
They actually darkened the hair a lot, and then they just spray painted it white, and then I got rid of the eyebrows, obviously, too. And you have the iconic Michael Myers mask.
And it's so awesome that they kind of stumbled upon this mask out of necessity, like and it's become so iconic. And that's just part of the charm of indie films, because we talked a little bit on the game show about how this was a lower budget film, and it actually ended up being one of the most profitable indie films ever made. But something so iconic could come out of that, you know, necessity to just, you know, kind of use your resources, your resourcefulness as a filmmaker. And, you know, they got pretty fortunate with this one.
Oh, yeah. So one of the things that's interesting, I think, about with the Halloween movies is how I don't know what the thinking is, but every time they make a new Halloween movie, they have to change the mask in some way. And I just don't understand that. Just do the same thing over again.
Well, actually, the interesting thing about that is, so when they did Halloween 2, the actual Halloween mask was over actually at somebody's house. And it got warped. It actually yellowed a bit because from cigarette smoke. And the actor who played Michael Myers in Halloween 2 was actually like thicker than the actual guy. So when you rewatch it, there are moments where you just see like, I just see a, like, this guy's fat and it doesn't look normal. Like, cause it's like, it's pretty bad. And you can actually see the guy's eyes this time around, unlike in Halloween where you hardly see Michael Myers' eyes.
I'm amazed that they just let someone take that home. Like who was it? Like the craft services guys? Like, oh yeah, I had that. I put it in my box.
Exactly. Yeah. I think the idea was there was not going to be a Halloween 2 because Carpenter wanted to be a one and done movie, just to be kind of like, well, this is what I can do. So let's do some more different movies.
What I think is very funny about when they ask him, like, so where do you get all his ideas for like Halloween 2? And he's like, six pack of beer and the paycheck they gave me. And, like, that's where he went, which is, you know, for those who have seen Halloween 2, I like Halloween 2. It's a fun enough movie, but it's a pale imitation of the original. And it does seem very funny that it's like between, like, you know, the end of one movie and the beginning of the other, which is later that night. You know, Michael Myers gained some weight, like, I guess he ate too much dog or something.
He stopped at the Krispy Kreme.
So, John, you sent me this graphic the other day with the Halloween timelines, because it kind of, over time, the series has kind of gone in different directions. Yeah. Some of the newer films have ignored a lot of the older ones. So what are your guys' favorite timelines as far as these sequels?
All right. Well, so I have to say my favorite timeline, which is, it'll probably be controversial, but I like the Halloween 1, 2, then 4, 5, and 6. Now, a lot of you are thinking a lot of those movies aren't very good. And that is true. But there's a lot of these other sequels that aren't very good either. So, you know, we could go tit for tat on that, my friend. But I would say that it's Halloween 4 is really underrated. And like the whole Jamie character, which is his niece, I believe. I find her character to be really interesting, and the connection between Michael and her. And it gets into some weird territories in 5 and 6, because apparently, folks, Michael is actually part of some druid cult that they did some blood sacrifice with him. And when there's like these stars align to make a thorn in the sky, that's when Michael kills, which apparently is all the Halloween movies is when he decides to kill, I guess. And it's so ridiculous. Paul Rudd's in it. It's, you know, it's worth checking out, I think. The producer's cut is way better than the original version that they, theatrical version. But yeah, no, it's a silly, silly movie. I also really like the I like Halloween and then the Halloween 2018 version. I think that shows, I'd like to see where the next two movies go, but I think that that timeline shows a lot of promise.
In the 2018 one, was Laurie supposed to be his sister as well in that one?
No, so it's literally just the first one.
Okay.
And then the 2018 version. So
they don't make any sort of connection in the 2018 one.
Nope. If anything, they go out of their way to ignore it. But not just ignore it. They go out of their way to have characters talk about something like, isn't she his sister? And they're like, no, that was just a rumor. I think that's what they have, which a little corny, but yeah. It is. I do. Okay. What do you guys think? Do you think it's better for her to be his sister, or is it better for her to just be a random person that he finds?
Okay. So I believe that when you attach an objective to something, I feel like it loses some of like the momentum of the killer.
The randomness of it.
I'd rather have it be random because there is no attachment. There's no strings showing you, like, you know, there's nothing that links you between Michael Myers and Laurie other than the fact that she survived and he's still alive as well. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't say it. It probably still bothers him.
Are you talking about the 2018 version?
Yeah, in the 2018 version. Maybe I'm jumping away ahead of myself, but
let's stick to the original.
Okay, we'll gotcha.
We're gonna have you on for the 2018, my friend. So it's
Jesus,
okay.
Spoilers, guys. Jesus.
Anyway, you were saying sorry.
So I just think the fact that Michael, he's just strolling and he's just following people around, and then he decides, okay, I'm going to kill these guys. You mm-hmm. know, and not
so you prefer like, you prefer the random aspect.
Absolutely, yeah. So I like the Halloween and Halloween 2018 timeline mm-hmm. a lot more.
Is there any other timeline you like? Because I think you've told me I think quite a few times that you're a huge fan of the third Halloween.
Absolutely. That is criminally unrated. I know the idea was to try to make the Halloween series an anthology. So I feel like it was going the right direction, but people are like, where's Michael Myers? Like, you know, because I think around that time, that's when serial killers started becoming the anti-heroes. And like people mm-hmm. start kind of cheering for serial killers rather than, you know, like, you know, get away. They're like, kill him, you know? So I think around that time, people wanted to see Michael Myers over the you know, Silver Shamrock masks. So, but like, again, I said, I think Halloween 3 is really good and I think it's overlooked. And I think some people should take another look at it because it's really good and it has like a different idea of like Halloween. And if that, like, you know, Tailspin, you can have gotten different stories like in the Halloween universe.
I remember when I was little, I would get the, I don't know what you call it. They were like the 5 movies, 5 days, $5, or you could do 6 movies, 6 days.
Right, yeah.
Those things at the local video store. So whenever I would get all the Halloween movies, I would always avoid the third one. I was like, that's not Michael Myers. So when I eventually got the, I feel like I'm bragging today about all these Scream Factory Blu-rays I have, but when I got the Halloween Scream Factory Blu-ray set, that was the first time, I think that was in like, I don't remember when it came out, but like, I watched Halloween 3 for the first time when that came out a couple of years ago. And I did feel very stupid for not watching it up until that point. So,
you did like it.
I really enjoyed it. Yeah. Yeah. It's a very different kind of movie. And it's very, it's a little silly too, but it's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the idea behind an anthology series is really cool with the concept of Halloween. I don't think they realized quite yet like what they had in Michael Myers and that like mm-hmm. that people wanted to keep seeing him. And it's also interesting too, if they did intend it to be an anthology, they probably shouldn't have made 2 like a direct sequel, because then people are kind of like still expecting him. So maybe just have started it as an anthology there.
Well, the thing is, they did pay John Carpenter a lot of money to write the sequel, and he's like, all right.
I'm going to stick with what I know. I already created this guy, so.
Yeah, I love him.
All right, so going back to the whole sister connection in Halloween, I'm kind of with Trevor that I kind of like the anonymity in the original. And I think that is interesting. And I think it is enough motivation for Michael Myers to want to get her, because this is his first night as a serial killer. You know, he took his training wheels off. He was a little kid. He got one out of the way. And like, this is his first night, and he's having a pretty good spree. And then Laurie foils it. And, you know, I think that's enough for Michael for him to be like, she's the one, like, I'm after her until this is over. But you know, the sister connection kind of makes sense, you know, with all the sequels, it opens up other possibilities. So I don't know. I get it either way.
I think at the time period, it being like, oh, actually she's his sister. Like it is like, oh, wow. You know, sort of
thing. It makes it more personal.
Yeah. And then as time has gone on, and all movie franchises, you know, horror franchises have this thing that now it's like, oh, it's nice to go in the opposite direction back to that, where we're like, oh, it's actually better if it's just random.
And the connection they make where she ends up being his sister, it's not like that much of a stretch. Like, when films do it nowadays to just kind of keep going for the sake of continuing to go and for the sake of a twist or a connection or whatever, sometimes it's a lot more of a stretch than this would be. So
yeah, like every Saw movie has some weird connections.
Right, exactly.
Jigsaw dies after the second one, but he's in, or third one, I don't remember, and he's in all the other movies and flashbacks, secretly having all these extra he has a bunch of wards out there.
So I gotta mention that, I think I've mentioned it on the show before, I am a Halloween H2O sympathizer, and I think it's underrated. I've been campaigning this for about 20 years or so. I don't know. I really like that one as a youngster. I haven't seen it in probably...
Also, but can we talk about how stupid that title is? It's H20. H2O. Right. Who gives a shit?
Exactly. The only thing I liked about that movie is Michael's blowouts. Like, if you look at the movie, he had like a blowout haircut. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't know why they can't. It's like, they either have like a mask that looks like it was like, it looks like merchandise of Halloween that was bought and used on set, or it's like really elaborate and decrepit looking. There's no like nice version of the first mask that's still used.
Actually, the funny thing is, they had a original mask, and halfway through the filming, they're like, I don't fucking like this mask. So they did a whole new mask. And since they were so far in, they're like, well, we can't reshoot some of these scenes. So they CGI a new mask. And actually, the scene where like Laurie and Michael are fighting in the like the lunchroom, they have a crappy CGI Michael Myers mask. And it just looks terrible. It looks like PlayStation 2 graphics.
Yeah. I think we all need to sit down and rewatch H2O, H20, H20, whatever you want to call it.
Maybe.
People forget it's one of LL Cool J's finest roles, and this is coming from a guy who's seen Deep Blue Sea. And
any additional thoughts, Jason? Do you have any more thoughts praising H20?
Yeah, I think I praised it enough. I went to bat for it. That's really all they can ask at this point.
And you also really liked Halloween Resurrection, correct?
No. That one was
really
quite awful.
Throwing one of the bus.
That was, could have done without that one.
So let's get into the plot of the movie. All right. You ready, Trevor?
Absolutely.
Trevor, you seem a little distant today.
I'm not distant. What are you talking about?
I don't know. You just seem a little bit distracted or something.
You told him to turn his mic down. Is that it?
No, I'm not.
Jason, don't fuck with him. You'll change the settings. All right. Halloween. So first we get the infamous point of view shot where it's Michael. We don't know it's Michael yet, but we see a person's watching Judith Myers and her boyfriend. They go upstairs for a quickie.
Very quick.
Actually, it was funny on the commentary. Jamie Lee Curtis comments upon it being like the fastest quickie ever. So she says something. I was like, oh, I love her. She's a treasure. Anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, Michael goes around the side of the house, goes in the back. he finds a knife, and then we see the boyfriend leaving after 20 seconds of being upstairs.
Like, I would
her.
Like to time how much time it took to take off the clothes and put them on, and then find out how much time was left in between, because it's not a lot. Yeah.
Also, the Judith is not even like still in the bed. She's like,
she's combing her hair. Or something.
Yeah, she's combing her hair. Like, so, yeah, Michael, he puts on a little mask, and then he just starts stabbing his sister, and she's bleeding. And he goes downstairs, goes outside, and terrible timing. The parents just show up, and they're like, Michael, what? And then we find out that the person doing the murder was a little 7-year-old child.
Mm-hmm.
Typical.
So one thing that I think is interesting is, like, that's the most we get out of his backstory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We don't ever learn why he went nuts, why he did that, you know? And it seems that, you know, his house, how the parents look and stuff, it's not like, you know, they're like middle class family. They, you know, they have a nice house. We don't really have any sort of understanding of what could have been the reason why he went crazy, which makes it scarier.
I think. There's really no indication that he's troubled, that he's a troubled child.
So the next scene we have, it's years later, and Loomis and a nurse are going to Smith's Grove to transfer Michael for, I guess it's supposed to be some sort of hearing that they're going to have about him and his mental state.
Mm-hmm.
And we learn that Michael hasn't talked in 15 years, which is, you know, not a good sign at all. And so when they get there, and it's, I remember finding this very creepy when I was little, like, they get to the Smith's Grove and the gate is open, and all of, like, the patients are in, like, their white.
Yeah. They're just wandering around.
They're wandering around.
And it's so eerie.
I guess it's like, because you never get a good look at any of the people. It's raining, it's dark, but like the white shirts kind of reflect off the light of the from the car. And then Loomis gets out of the car to do something, I forget, but Michael breaks into the car, gets in the car, kicks the nurse out, drives away. And which apparently Michael doesn't talk, but somehow learned how to drive. I think that's interesting.
Priorities.
Isn't there a comment that, like, oh, he learned, apparently, or he can drive, apparently, something like that.
He was doing very well last night.
Yeah.
Start doing donuts in the parking lot. Fuck you, Loomis.
I just like how it's, like, the way that it just kind of moves along, though. It's like, all right, we get it. He's out.
It's a very economical opening. A lot happens and they convey a lot of information. You know, just to go back even to that first shot, that POV, I think that's for the most part a one shot, right? They have
a couple masked, like, cuts. Like when he puts on the mask, they cut it.
Yeah. And obviously, but cuts at the end to show the shot of the house and everything. But yeah, really, really cool shot. That one always stuck with me. Just like the image of the little kid just there with the knife and the clown suit.
Well, also, it's like funny because if you stare at them as the camera's moving back, it doesn't quite make sense why they take off the mask, they go, Michael, and then they stare at him holding the knife, and then it's like 20 seconds of them just frozen standing looking at him. Like, but it's with the music.
It works.
And stuff, and the way that you see just more and more of, like, just a regular neighborhood, etc. Like, it really works. And, you know, I don't know. John Carpenter, he's great. I love his, like, he has a very, like, classical filmmaking sense while also doing unique things like point of view. But he has, like, this, like, even when it's, like, a point of view shot, like, the camera is so, like, buttery smooth and steady as, like, the camera moves around. Like, he knows how to command that, and it makes it more uncomfortable, like, just that kind of steady thing, because it's like he moves with, like, a deliberate pace.
That was probably very hard to pull off in the 70s with the equipment. That was probably very heavy for whoever did that. So I thought, props to that camera
operator. I could be wrong, but I think this might have been pre-Steadicam, because I thought the Steadicam was first used in The Shining. But I won't commit to that because I'll get yelled at by people.
Because I got to fact check you now.
You can't just trust your dates. So, all right. After Michael steals the car, drives away perfectly, we see Lori. Her dad makes her drop off the keys at the Myers house. We don't find out if they sell the house or not.
Yeah, he's a realtor, and he's trying to sell the old haunted Myers house.
That's like it's very, like, classic I don't know, sitcom trope or something. Like, oh, you can't sell the old murder house.
I'd like to hear from our realtor listeners out there if they've ever had to sell a supposedly haunted house. I don't know if you have to put that in like the seller's disclosure or something.
Actually, you do. You have to put in disclosure. Oh, by the way, there was like a big murder here. Yeah. You know,
no big deal. Might not have been a murder in the upstairs bedroom. And there's a water leak in the basement.
So we see Lori. She goes to the Myers house. She puts the key under the doormat. And then we see like kind of a perspective shot from Michael where we hear him breathing and he's watching her from the other side of the door. Then he comes out and then just watches her as she's like, you know, walking down the block. And we get that like very creepy, like breathing pattern that like if you have a mask on, you can hear that. So very unsettling. And we get that a lot where we hear Michael breathing and we know he's near. I think that's like the start of that.
Yeah.
So then we get the, like, I say it's like an iconic shot where Lori's in class. And then I mentioned this earlier. She turns and looks outside and she sees Michael standing there watching her from like his stolen car that he's still driving, which you would think would be very easy to find him if he's driving the car that he stole. Like,
that's labeled too. It's got the logo on and everything.
Yeah. It's like, I think what they were saying, it was almost like 150 miles away or something. So I would think it would kind of stick out a little, but yeah,
no, that's a really cool shot through the Venetian blinds. And, you just see kind of Michael's head framed and spooky.
And it's from her perspective. So it's not like you get like a close up of him or anything. You just get a general view and you can't really make out the face or anything yet.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so that whole scene, that whole shot's become a trope too. The whole like student looking out the window and then the teacher calls on them and then they're always the smartest kid in the class. So, you know, the teacher was like, you weren't listening. But then the kid's like, I was listening. And then they answer. and then the teacher's like, oh, yeah, you're right. And then they look back outside. Killer's gone. Spooky guy's gone.
I just imagine Michael just like scuttling away, like just like trying to
get like the second she looks away, he just jumps into the car and it just like pulls away.
He goes down a block and he's like, nailed it.
Yes.
Got it.
Shit, yes. I left the car there though.
All right. So next scene, we got Lori, Linda, Annie, and they're walking home and we get a lot of details that I think it kind of fleshes out the characters, but ultimately is not very like important to the actual like plot of the story we're seeing. But basically what we know is that Lori and Annie are going to be babysitting across the street from one another. And that Annie's, I guess she was going to, her boyfriend was going to come over, but he got grounded.
What a dweeb.
And I guess Linda is going to bring her boyfriend Bob over to the house that Annie is going to be at, and they're going to just go to the other bedroom. Okay.
Trying to beat the record of the quickest quickie. Yeah.
And Lori's like, yeah, no, that's interesting. God damn it. I forgot my chemistry book. And I like that Linda's like, oh, I forgot my chemistry book too. And my math book. And my English. And she's like, I never read. I don't know how. No. So we get kind of the vibe that Lori is like a real goody goody. But I think what I like about it is that she is that way. But also she's like, she takes it in stride. Like they like kind of pick on her a little bit. But they also know not to, like, it's not like they're like, you know, just destroying her over being like a dork. It's like they make little jokes and then she's like, oh, okay, very funny, guys.
Yeah,
you know?
She's the smart girl in the friend group.
Yeah, it's not like you're hanging out with John or anything.
Yeah. I told you not to talk about that.
I'm the king.
Trevor, you've been warned. Anyway, so you get a kind of a good sense of all those characters. And it's kind of setting up the, you know, the ensuing night that we're going to see all hell break loose.
Yeah. And during all of this, you know, Loomis is still on the trail trying to track Michael back. And then that's when we see the abandoned car and the dead body. And that's, I guess that's where Michael got his jumpsuit as well.
Actually funny. Oh, not funny. Actually, interesting fact on that. The actual jumpsuit is actually a forest green, but somehow how the movie was lit or the filter they used on the camera, it comes out the navy blue. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting on how it actually happened. But
yeah,
honestly, though, I think good.
I believe what part of that was is that when they were filming this, they filmed it in California. So it had like more of a, I think it had a little bit more of a, like a yellower tone to the film. So they kind of, I think they tried to make it a little bit more, add more blue to it. So it creates like, it looks more like a Midwest like look to it as opposed to like sunny California.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that might be part of it.
Right. I thought it was actually because green really clashes with his mask and the blue really brings out the, you know, the color of his hair. That's what I thought, but okay. I was gonna say, that's the joke.
Trevor, we love you. One thing I liked was when I think it's just Annie and Lori walking, and it's like they see Michael driving by, and this is such a 70s kind of insult. Hey, jerk. Speed kills. And then he stops the car immediately, like, what did you say?
I thought he actually got more mad the fact that was such a weak comeback. Like, you know, like, yeah. Really? Of all the things you could have said.
All right, you're first. You're going first. So they all separate as they're going home. And Lori, she sees Michael in the bushes at first. And then when she's in her house, she looks out in the backyard. And I don't know if it's her backyard or the neighbor's. But he's just standing there next to the clothesline. And she looks back and he's gone. And I think it's interesting how that when rewatching this and trying to look at it as like a first time viewer, it's like I noticed more of the stuff where she's like, I'm really creeped out. Like she lays on her bed for a minute. She's like, you're going crazy, you know. Mm-hmm. And she is like processing that she keeps seeing like this weird looking guy.
Do you think does she think she's just seeing things? Like what makes mm-hmm. her not all that concerned about it? I guess these were simpler times and people just, you know, the 70s, people just trusted each other more. But nowadays, if you see anybody in more than one instance staring at you in a mask, I think that sets off alarm bells. She gives him a lot of passes, like, and just kind of like brushes it off.
Well, here's the thing. I think everything up until she looks in the backyard and he's standing there, you could go, oh, it's just like some weirdo in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But like your backyard or whatever, That's kind of quite a coincidence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so like we get her and Annie, they get in the car, they go drive to do their little babysitting gigs. And we're treated to a scene where we see like the hardware store was broken into, the alarm's going off and the sheriff's there. And, you know, the sheriff is Annie's father. So Annie and Lori, they pull over, talk to him a minute while he like lets, you know, give some exposition of like, oh, some crazy kids stole a mask, some rope, knives, you know.
No big deal.
Yeah. You know, serial killer thing.
Yeah.
So they're like, okay, we'll see you later. And they drive away. And then Loomis shows up and he's like, can I talk to you? He's like, in a minute, I got to do stuff. And then while Loomis is standing there, you see Michael pull around right behind him. And they stay on Loomis as he's going, I wonder where he is.
Yeah,
and
where
he's
could like, he? Loomis is like looking up and down.
I will wait here. Huh? You know,
Loomis spends a lot of the movie just standing in the same spot.
For such a smart guy, he's a little slow. Like he doesn't know. Like, yeah, like he shows up at the Myers house and he's just standing around most of the movie.
And the one I love the reveal when he sees Michael's car parked across the street. He's almost like, oh, when did that get there? It's just like,
what are the odds?
He's spending the whole night trying to freak out the kids to go away from the house that he knows no one is in.
Yeah. And I'm imagining Michael like parking there. He's like, oh, there's Loomis. And he like pulls up and he just like very quietly gets out. Like, gently shuts the door.
Oh, I would have loved it if like Loomis is messing with the kids and you just see Michael in the background, like
unloading
away.
A rope and the knives.
Yeah. Drops one of the knives, actually has to pick it up and eat more time up. And
you see him pointing and laughing. So we get Loomis I actually really like this scene with Loomis too, where he goes to look for Judith Myers' grave, and the gravedigger is like walking him to the spot, and the gravedigger is talking about like, yeah, you know, there's a lot of towns have these like weird, you know, backstories. Let me tell you about this like murder of like a family, and he's talking about it, and then like Loomis cuts him off like, yeah, whatever. I'm looking for the grave. Is this the grave? What's supposed to be here? Just like, I just love that he like just kind of just bats him on. Yeah, whatever. I don't give a shit. I'm the therapist of one guy, and he's evil, and I'm going to put him down. You don't need to be burdening me with any of this other crap, all right? So they find the plot, and the tombstone, it's gone. Which, you know, quite a coincidence for, you know, a homicidal maniac is on the loose, and possibly in Haddonfield, and his sister's grave has been...
And just the mere size and weight of that is kind of creepy in itself, because you can imagine they would have to get a forklift or something to lift it up. But no, just one dude just lifted up like, whoop.
That's one of the first indications of his super strength.
Yeah.
I would love to see like the time lapse of him trying to remove it. Just like digging and like, it takes hours and hours and he finally gets it. And that like, that's what he used the rope for, to just like drag it out of the.
Yeah.
All right. So we see Michael. He watches Annie go into a house, and so Annie is watching a little girl named Lindsay, and across the street we got Lori is watching Tommy, which, by the way, Jason, since you haven't seen the Halloween 6, I can't remember the actual name for that, but Paul Rudd plays the little kid Tommy, grown up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little...
That's cool.
Right, so then we got Loomis and the sheriff. They go over to the, you know, Michael's old house. They go inside and they find a nice, I guess, a dead dog that Michael, what does he say? I guess like Michael got hungry or something. Like, I guess he got hungry. I was just like, it's very weird.
He could have stopped at Arby's.
Well, it's like he was at the hardware store. Like, he could have just broken in somewhere else.
And exactly.
Wouldn't that have been much easier than just like, I got a dog, now I'm going to bite it.
Yeah, it's not like... In the institution, he acquired the taste for dog. It's like he ate normal food for 15 years. Why is he suddenly eating dogs?
I mean, I imagine if he got a Snickers, this killing wouldn't have been a problem. He would have just been okay.
You're so fucking corny, Trevor.
I love it, because normally I'm the corny one, and Trevor just takes some of the spotlight off of me.
Yeah, he's doubling down tonight. Yeah. Okay.
You're not you when you're hungry, Michael Myers. Snickers, if you're listening, want to send us some money. No, nobody can see me doing the money thing, but I'm doing the money thing.
Loomis explains his genius plan to stay at the house.
To stand in the same spot.
Yeah, to wait for Michael, which... I don't know, like, ignoring like movie tropes, if you're like, oh, this guy is probably going to go on a killing spree and he's already been to his house, wouldn't you just assume he's not going to come back till he's done killing? Like, that'll be like, yeah, all right, I've done my killing for the day. I'm going to take a nap now at the at my house. I would think you'd want to be anywhere but that house to find him. I don't know.
Well, this is why I want to know a little bit more of the backstory with Loomis and Michael, is like, he's so certain that he's going back to the house, which I get, and it works in the film, but like, what is his motivation to go back to the house? It's not like there's unfinished business there or anything. It's just like, how does Loomis sense that he has this draw to his childhood home?
I don't know. I feel like with the later films, they kind of double down on him being like kind of a crackpot. Mm-hmm. Like, he's like singularly like, oh, Michael, he's like always raving to people about Michael. So I'm not really sure what he's getting from that, especially Michael hasn't talked in 15 years. I mean, did he see some paintings of the old house that finger painted or something? I don't know.
Right.
Like,
is one of the ultimate twists in the sequels that like Loomis is a patient too, and like he escaped the same night?
Actually, that would have really worked very well.
Honestly, that doesn't really feel that far off with the way he acts in like the later movies, you know? Well, that was the one thing I was thinking, is like, he seems way more dignified in this than in the like other films, where they're we'll pay him whatever he needs, because he will add some like class to this like cash grab movie.
I think Dr. Loomis actually feels personally responsible for the fact that Michael is out, because he probably wanted to do some something a lot sooner to prevent this from happening, because he probably thought this would happen sometime, somewhen. He didn't know when. And I think that's what the hearing was, to actually lock him up forever with no chance whatsoever to get out. And all of a sudden, the day before, boom, he breaks out.
Yeah. I think also, like, or at least I'm not sure if this is really indicated too much in the film, but my read on this was mostly that, like, Loomis tried for a very long time to get through to him. He never did. You know, Michael shut down after a while. And I guess it's in some ways he also feels responsible because he never was able to get through to him to help him.
Yeah, I'm sure he does feel responsibility.
And then now it's like, well, if I can't fix him, I'll kill him. So, yeah, I don't know. I think it's an interesting dynamic between Michael and Loomis. I think, unfortunately, none of the other films, I think, really, like, they don't really get at anything significant or have any depth to that. But
yeah, that dynamic is interesting to me, but I know there's not much to explore since they said he didn't talk for 15 years. So it's just kind of like, would just be Michael sitting there.
Yeah. So we have Annie. She's dealing with Lindsay. She, for some reason, spills butter all over herself, and then she just disrobes right in the kitchen.
Yeah, her immediate instinct is to just strip down.
Like, the 70s were wild, my friend.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Michael's watching her from outside. Of course.
Yeah.
Wide open window, really brightly lit room.
Yeah. And then doesn't he knocks over like one of those hanging pots. Exactly. So Annie hears a hanging pot drop while she's like topless. And then the dog goes out there, and then you hear the dog get like choked like and murdered. And then she's like, stupid dog. Am I right? So then she decides, I'm going to have to wash my clothes right now. So she, I guess, like, they have like a separate, I don't know what you'd call it. It's like a
detached laundry room.
Yeah.
Past the backyard.
Yeah.
So you got to go through the backyard to get to the laundry room.
So she goes there. She puts in all her clothes to wash. And then I guess Michael follows her and locks the door. She can't get out. So then she goes through the window and she gets stuck in the window.
Michael's an impractical joker.
Poor Annie.
He props up like a rake or something on the door.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like, so, does that work? I see that all the time in movies. Chairs and rakes. And it's just like, have people had success barricading doors like that?
Yeah, actually it is. It's all about like the momentum, like actually, because like the legs actually stop it from going, like it, the way you prop it.
Wait, Trevor.
Trevor's door is currently set up like that.
Trevor, do you not have locks in your house? You just have rakes?
Yes, exactly. Why do you think I work at Lowe's? Come on.
They're like, you know we sell locks here too, right?
Not with this kind of discount.
Five more rakes.
While Annie's like stuck in the window trying to get out, little Lindsay gets a call from her boyfriend. Is it Paul?
Yeah.
And she's like, all right, I'll get her. So she realizes the door is locked. She unlocks the door and then helps Annie back her way out of the window. So then Annie goes, calls back her boyfriend, Paul, and then Paul's telling her, hey, pick me up. My parents are gone, so I'm no longer grounded. She's like, all right, I'll pick you up. So then she is like, all right, Lindsay, you want to take a ride with me? And Lindsay's like, no. She's like, all right, I'll drop you off at Lori's, and you can hang out with Tommy. And she's like, oh, okay, I'll hang out with Tommy. So Annie drops off Lindsay with Tommy, and it's like, Lori's like, hey, can you watch them for a little bit? Hanging out with my boyfriend. So Annie goes back to Lindsay's house, gets in the car, and then, God damn it, Michael's in there and chokes her to death. I think he stabs her too, right? Like at the end.
Yeah.
He like gives her a little stab.
Yeah, you actually see some blood splurt on the window too.
Yeah, he took a stab at it.
That was
Oh,
that's the name of the podcast.
He did it.
That's all, folks. It's been fun.
Stab you later.
Stab you later.
That's my line. No, all right. Well, anyway, so Michael kills her. Very like uncomfortable. Especially because like she slowly like falls in her seat and her eyes are open. And she's like,
so that was her car, right? Like at first I thought she was trying to start like one of the owners of the house's car.
I don't remember. Maybe she was borrowing the other car. I don't know. We don't have to look into it that much.
Yeah. A lot of liberties are taken with these babysitters. These were much easier things to get away with in the 70s before nanny cams and everything. But
yeah. Also, like, Tommy literally sees Michael bring Annie's lifeless body back into the house, which Michael, somehow criminal genius, yet goes to the front door in front of all the neighbors. And then Tommy's like, you know, trying to tell Lori, "I saw the boogeyman." And she's like, "Shut up. You didn't see anything." Meanwhile, she herself was been like spending the whole day going, "I think I saw the boogeyman outside my house." It's like, no, stupid. Yeah. There's no such thing as a boogeyman.
She didn't make any of those connections.
Yeah.
Then we get Linda and Bob arrive at the house that Annie's watching, and they're like, "Nobody's home. I guess we'll just hang out inside.
We'll just make ourselves real comfortable."
Exactly.
And so they're hanging out on the, they get a call from Lori. They find out that Lindsay is staying with Lori and Tommy. So they have the whole house to themselves, which proceeds to have another very fast quickie upstairs.
It's quickie time.
Which I also love that, like, she's like, "All right, that's cool and everything. That was fun. You know, get me a beer, Bob."
Yeah. And he's not even like, okay, they just like destroy that room. Like, the sheets are everywhere. And then they smoke in the room. Yeah. Like, it's like there's at no point are they like, "All right, well, let's just make sure to leave this place untouched. Annie could lose her babysitting job, which she needs to, you know, make money."
Not anymore.
Yeah.
So he goes downstairs, and then what I think is probably one of the more, probably the most like memorable kill in the movie is when he's getting the beers, he hears a noise, turns around, Michael just like starts choking him, like raises him up.
Super strength.
Yeah, super strength, and then stabs him with the knife, and it goes through him, and then he just kind of stays stuck on the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I gotta say, you know, I'm not really an expert contractor, but I want to get the number of that guy, because if a knife with a guy in it.
Hold on,
Okay, let me start over. Let me start over again. Okay. With a guy being stuck to the wall with a knife is still there and nothing has budged.
Yeah.
Hats off to you, good sir, man.
You want the number for that drywall guy.
Absolutely. Yeah.
A knife with a guy in it.
Whatever.
I want the murder grade drywall, please.
Yeah. Can we? But anyway, the best part of that scene, though, is when Michael like lets go of the knife and he kind of stands back and he tilts his head like he's just kind of admiring his work.
Like he just painted his masterpiece and he's just like, stepping back and like, "Pretty good. I could get used to this.
I think I'm Banksy."
pretty good. This is like probably the strangest murder right after that, which is to mess with the girl that's by herself in the house, Linda. He, as a little distraction, he puts on like a sheet, cuts out eye holes, and puts on Bob's glasses and walks in and then just stands there as she talks to him.
Yeah.
It is super creepy, though.
Like, it's very creepy, but like,
you don't like the move. You don't like that move.
I don't know. Like, I just feel like we're getting a little insight into Michael. It's a little,
right.
We're seeing some more artistry here. Like, he's tilting his head at a murder painting. Then he's like, "Okay, I'm just going to stare at her and see what she does." Then, she's like, "All right, fine. Don't talk to me or look at my boobs. Whatever. You're not saying anything." So then she calls Lori. And then while she's calling Lori, Michael comes up and chokes her with the cord. And then Lori thinks she's just making sex noises to mess with her. But then it starts to sound like real murder noises instead of sex noises. So Michael puts the phone to his ear and like listens and starts breathing. She hangs up, I believe, calls back, and then no one's answering. And then we have a scene with Loomis, which we mentioned earlier, about him realizing, there's Michael's car. Let me walk down the street. And I think we also have like the sheriff shows up going like, "Oh, what are you doing?" And he goes, "I found his car. Go around the other way." Like, I like that he makes the sheriff of the town as his backup. I'm going to go the main streets. You do the back, you know, behind the houses, like giving him like the grunt work of like, you're not the A-list material here, buddy.
Yeah, it's the Scooby-Doo tactic. Let's split up, gang.
All right, so Lori goes across the street. She goes upstairs and then she goes into the bedroom and finds Annie like kind of sprawled out on the bed with the tombstone of Judith Myers there. And she finds all the bodies.
They're all conveniently right in that room. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Michael, he's been prepping this for a while.
Yeah, he has. Yeah, yeah. A lot of heavy lifting. Yeah. I mean, it's impressive that he got the headstone up the stairs.
Exactly.
I just picture him like putting it on the bed and he's just like, worth it.
I want to see the HGTV special on that. Like him decorating the house, flip it or flop, you know.
After that, we get a really, I think this kind of shot happens a few times after this, but it's always effective where it's like Lori is standing somewhere. We hear the breathing. And then behind her, out of focus, we see Michael's face start like appearing in the dark.
Oh, yeah.
And I believe like what they used, they had like a spotlight that they slowly like turned up mm-hmm. so that we could see more of his face over that.
Really cool shot. Yeah.
Very amazing shot. So he attacks her and then she falls down the steps and she's like, all right, I'm getting the fuck out of here and runs back to Tommy's house. And I guess Tommy and Lindsay are both like sleeping. She forgot to bring the keys. So the door's locked. She can't open it. And then Michael's just walking towards her and she's like throwing stuff at the window. Tommy, get down here. And then finally, you know, he comes down, lets her in. The window's wide open. And then you hear Michael's breathing. He stands up from behind the couch, gets her arm only, which amateur move on his part, but it is his first day.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think a boss's move is, so she grabs a crochet needle and just stabs him in the neck.
Yeah.
And then he drops.
Yeah.
Glass jaw Michael.
Yeah.
And this is her first instance of just assuming that he's dead. Assuming that's the end of it.
Yes. Because she lives in the real world where like there aren't just like evil incarnate characters around. It's just, oh, well, if you get stabbed in the neck, you're down. So
yeah, she goes back upstairs at that point. And leaves the knife, which probably not a great move.
Not a great move, but she seems pretty resilient without the knife. I'll say that. I think.
She does. Yeah.
She's there. She's telling the kids, like, don't worry, he's dead now. And then he's walking right towards them. So I think she yells for them to go hide.
Yeah.
Okay. So then he like tries to go into the room that Lori's in. And Lori tries to mess with him by opening like a door that goes to like a deck outside, and then she hides in a closet and she like uses a wire hanger to tie it closed, and then she just kind of sits there, and he is not he does not fall for it one bit. He goes right towards the closet.
Yeah.
And he breaks in. She fights back. She takes she pokes him in the eye.
That was very precise too.
Yeah.
That one's an interesting move. I like the tactic of trying to make Michael think that she kind of jumped off the balcony or climbed down the balcony.
Yeah.
But I don't know about hiding in that closet. Like, she's already seen him punch through a normal door. She's like, I'm going to hide in this really thin, cheap closet door. You're really trapping yourself at that point. She probably would have been better off just jumping out of the balcony. But
leaving the kids like, fuck you.
Hey, he's just worried about her.
Yeah.
Like, the sooner she gets out, she can kind of call the cops and address the situation. But I get the thought behind it. It would have been nice if it worked out. But I love the shot in the closet, how the light turns on. It's just so eerie. Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. That's such a cool shot. That one always stuck with me as a youngster.
And when he gets stabbed, he drops the knife. And then she takes the knife and just like, gets him. And then he drops. And,
he's dead.
He's dead for real this time because I stabbed him with a bigger instrument. So she then tells the kids, like, go to the neighbor's house, get them to call the police. And I love that the kids think, okay, what that means is as soon as we get out of the house, we should just start screaming at the top of our lungs. So they do that. And Loomis is like, oh, shit, I know where he is now.
So Loomis is just wandering the streets at this point.
All according to plan.
He's left his post.
Yeah. So then we have.
He's at the right place at the right time, though.
He is, yeah. though. And he goes upstairs.
What if it was another crime happening and he's like, I don't have time for this. And he just leaves. Yeah, exactly.
Wait, is that Michael? No. Ah, I don't give a shit. Lori's kind of, I think she dropped or whatever to the ground. She's like exhausted, obviously. And then you see Michael sit up. Then she stands up, and then he gets up and he starts walking towards her. They start fighting. Loomis comes up the steps and then just unloads his revolver into Michael. Then Michael just drops out the balcony onto the ground.
And he dies.
And yeah, now supposedly. He's dead. Supposedly. Yeah. So then she's like, oh, was that the boogeyman? She says it was the boogeyman. He goes, I believe it was.
Yes.
And I love the ending of this is so good. So he walks out. All right. And then he looks out there. Obviously, Michael's gone. But I love this idea. Like, so the music starts swelling and then it cuts to all these dark places in the house outside and stuff where it's just like, and you just hear his breathing getting louder and louder. Like, he's now become like kind of like this like supernatural figure that you never know, like, if he's coming for you or not. Yeah, you know, yeah. Like, and it really kind of drives that home and is so scary because. He gets away at the end. And if you're a kid, you're watching this, you're like, God damn it. He's still around.
Yeah. And Loomis doesn't even seem one bit surprised. Like, he shot him six times. Yeah. He fell off a balcony. He's laying there dead, supposedly. Mm-hmm. And then Loomis walks out. He's like, oh, great, great. I feel this going on for another 5 or 6 movies at least.
Maybe a remake or so. And then another sequel.
You know, I don't know if this is true, if I read it somewhere, someone told me, or if I dreamt it up. I don't know if you guys can shed some light on it, but the closing sequence of all the shots, the dark spots of the house and everything. I heard that they just had to go. They went back through just random B-roll shots and it was still set up for the scene, but it was a time when like the camera was rolling when they weren't, you know, the scene wasn't going, and they just pieced together that ending from that. Like, it wasn't scripted that way or really storyboarded. I don't know if you guys ever heard that, but
I don't know. I don't know too much more on that, but I do think that's really awesome that they were able to build that.
Yeah. And it makes sense too, because the one shot of the living room is the exact same angle of when, you know, the scene takes place.
Yeah.
And you can see that the knife is actually still laying there. So it's like, this is supposed to represent like after these events have happened, when Michael actually took the knife with him, but you know, it's still there from that scene. So,
yeah. Well, that's it for the movie. So, you know, looking back at the other films in our series so far, Peeping Tom, Psycho, Texas Chainsaw, Black Christmas, we're now kind of, I think this is now the point where we're at like slasher films at their peak.
This is the prototype. We have now formed
the prototype.
Yeah, yeah. The prototype, right, right. The roadmap that will be followed for every slasher film
going forward.
We see a little bit of the four films we watched already. Kind of incorporated into this. I know we talked in Black Christmas, we talked how, you know, the director may or may not have inspired the entire idea for Halloween. So there's obviously that influence. And, you know, we got the POV thing used, which we saw in Black Christmas and Peeping Tom, you know, that's used in the opening shot and throughout.
What's interesting with this one, I think, is more, I think the idea of POV shots has been a little bit more internalized in viewers. So like, he can now have a much more steadier, deliberate, like, camera moves that are supposed to be POV. And we kind of get it. We don't need it to be like more handheld or shaky.
Yeah.
Be able to decipher the difference, you know.
And I think this is the first time in this slasher series where the POV actually works as a way to not reveal Michael right away. We get glimpses of him throughout, and that we haven't quite seen that yet. Like Peeping Tom, we know what he looks like. We follow him the whole movie. You know, Psycho to a degree, but it's Norman. And, you know, and then the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, we kind of just see him the whole time. And, and then Black Christmas, we never really even, you know, see the whole killer. We just catch glimpses of him. So this is Halloween's kind of a combination of that. It's just this gradual reveal of Michael Myers. And it's just so brilliant. You know, we see him the first time we see his face is that shot we talked about through the blinds at the school.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's just so great. Like, all you see is his head, and then just we get more of him as it goes.
Yeah, he gradually gets closer and closer.
Yeah.
And also, I would say, I mean, for the most part, most of these other movies, their characters, the bad guys or killers, talk. You know, Texas Chainsaw Leatherface doesn't really, but I mean...
But the other people close to him do the talking for him, almost. Yeah.
So they talk. So... But you get like more of like we were saying before, more of a backstory, more of an understanding of where these bad guys, what their origin, what does that come, what that came from, what's driving them. And this one, it's blank slate. We don't ever hear him talk. And, you know, at the end of it, we're left wondering and having all these other questions about it. And, you know, it's just, I don't know. It's interesting to see how to see those comparisons there.
Yeah. The origin story is always fascinate me. I think it's really interesting how, you know, whether it be superheroes or, you know, villains or slashers or whatever, just like how someone became who they became. And, you know, we have caught glimpses of that with some of these slashers. And, you know, like John said, with Halloween, it's, you know, a little bit of a mystery, and that's scary in itself.
What's funny is, and I think what a lot of movies get wrong sometimes about the origin story kind of thing is, if you make a movie about somebody, about something, and then like three or four films later, you then give some new origin to that character, and like you show some backstory, it's like, that is always the wrong way to do it. Mm-hmm. It's always like, if you're introducing a character and you want to have a certain backstory, it needs to be baked into the movie, into like the genetics of it or something. You
totally.
Know?
Right. And you know, with series like this, it becomes kind of like, you know, there's a more, I guess, corporate or studio element to it. So sometimes, you know, there's outside influence to what the story might be. You know, it's these, I can't speak for all the sequels, but I, you know, they started as more indie projects. But then when you get into these remakes or, you know, these bigger budget sequels, the studio could be like, well, you got to explain this about Michael. Like, why add this? Yeah. But I think it's just like, and they talk about, you know, if you take like writing classes or do writing exercises, you know, at the very beginning, when you're mapping out your story and you're coming up with your characters, you want to have a backstory for all your characters. Even if you don't use it or reference it in that story, you still, as the author, should understand where your character came from and what their motivation is. So yeah, and that goes back to having it kind of baked into the story. And I think that, like, you know, more horror films should consider that, especially if they're thinking about going on for so long. Cause when you get these sequels that it's like this contrived backstory, it almost makes the killer, the subject, a little less interesting and a less, you know, less formidable when you try to over explain where they came from.
I just realized this now, but most of the things we've talked about so far are all like indie films or films that were like made, you know, like the director wanted to make this story.
Right.
You know, so we're getting a lot of like these, the storytelling that they're offering, like none of it's really like, it's a gig. Yeah, whatever. You know, it's like something they wanted to do and they like worked to make it. And it's just interesting going forward when we start to look at like kind of the films that are made in the wake of these kind of like classics and how those films tend to be very reverential to like these films. And it's more of like they're kind of reflecting some of this stuff back to the audience, some of the tropes and whatever. Whereas this stuff is very much like unique like filmmaker visions that we're getting. And I think these are very like wonderful movies so far that we've talked about. And,
oh, yeah. You know, the group of films we watched so far have been awesome. You picked some good ones, John. Pat yourself on the back.
Yep, exactly.
I can't reach. I'm going to cut that out.
No, you leave that shit in.
Anyway, we got some hard questions here, folks. So, Trevor.
Yes, sir.
You love Halloween, right?
Yep.
Michael Myers, is he probably one of your favorite killers in movies?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he is probably like the top there, if not the best one.
Okay. I'm teeing you up for another question. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. So, Trevor.
Yes.
Would you survive this killer?
See, like, I'm 50-50 on that because, like, I know for a fact that I'm probably not going to have to deal with some of the bullshit of, like, you know, suburban America. But at the same time, I do undress in the kitchen if I get butter spilt on me. especially, I make sure the windows are open, too. So any peeping Tom or any looky-loo can look through and, like, oh, there's Trevor's panties. No, so, I mean... I'd oh, probably
he's,
say
he's a cheeky one. I
know. No,
did Goofy just come on?
A bashful. No, but putting all that together, I don't stand a chance against Michael. Nothing's gonna stop him. If he wants to kill me, he's gonna kill me.
So, Jason, what about you?
I'm a little torn as well, but you know, Michael, he's the best. He's a, you know, first ballot Hall of Fame slasher. and I think I just got to respect that. I don't think I would survive. I feel like I could outrun him or.
But he always shows up later somewhere else.
At least high. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like I could do that for a bit, but I think he would just catch up to me. And I feel like at some point I just, you know, that'd be it. I'd give up. And
yeah.
I don't know.
I don't think I would be able to beat him in any meaningful sense. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing. I don't think I'd even be able to get a good stab in there first. Like, I think I would like try. He would like bat it out of my hand and be like really embarrassed for me.
And then just he hands it back to you.
try again.
Go ahead, little guy.
That would be so scary if that was a scene.
If he just hands it back to you.
Yeah. Like, come on, try again.
Like you think he's going to stab you and then he just flips it over and gives you the hand. Oh man.
He beats me with the handle to death. Jeez. I'm like whimpering and he's so embarrassed he just walks away. I'm like,
he spares you. So maybe you would survive. He would
they're being so pathetic.
Well, he could always blade to you, or he beats you up in the beginning of the movie. At the end of the movie, he's like, do you think I forgot about you? And then kills you.
Well, okay. I feel like that's what would happen to me. So none of us would probably survive. Michael would live on.
Yep.
Anything else, gentlemen?
I don't know. I think we covered it all. I mean, we got the King of Halloween with us, so.
Yeah, yep,
exactly.
Knife with a guy in it. I'm sorry, Trevor. We love you. You know it.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. Thank you for always having me on. You know, I enjoy doing all these. You know, I'm pretty much, you know, the guy. I got how many episodes I've been on? Like 5 or 6 already?
You're the guy? What does
that
mean?
I'm the guy.
You're the guy. Okay.
I'm the guy and the king.
You're not the king of Halloween. You're just the guy.
I'm the guy who is the king of Halloween.
We have it on record. You are going from the king of Halloween to the guy.
Yeah, you're just the guy. all right. That does it for this week's episode. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. Next week, we will be reviewing A Nightmare on Elm Street. Until then, stab you later.
Jack-o'-lanterns and that 15-foot skeleton at Halloween.
That can't be very comfortable.
Damn, come on! What the fuck? I'm sorry, John. Hold on.
Yeah. Is this a bit? I don't know what's going on.
This is not a bit.
It would appear that the Banshee has gotten Trevor.
Sorry, guys. Rest there was in peace. Weird technical difficulties. I don't know what the fuck happened.
Do you want to just start over?
Yeah, I hope you guys don't mind.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Let's Take a Stab at It. I'm
sorry. I just started thinking about D.
He's like, what the fuck?
I'm normally not like that.
That's going at the end.
Just keep it all in there, man. Let's just keep going. Who cares?